In the 70s, there was a thing called, I'm okay, you're okay. I had only passing knowledge of it in its day, mainly because I was too busy getting high. I wish I was kidding about that. But in 12th grade, a lot of goals were secondary to me. Goals like mastering geometry, interpreting poetry, understanding political science, or pretty much anything academic. It was all about being accepted in a social group, and in my adolescent mind, that meant getting high. There wasn't much risk with mastering geometry or political science, but with getting high, there was considerable risk, and that's what got me suspended from school. One of the conditions for my return to school was enrollment in the Discovery Center. The Discovery Center was a converted house downtown that had daily meetings that were called encounter groups. What could be more cool than that, I thought. And really, it wasn't the getting high that was important as much as it was belonging to a group. So I eagerly attended the first meeting where I met Peter Strauss, the director of the Discovery Center. Peter had been my freshman English teacher, and he had disappeared. I learned that he had disappeared 3 years ago because he had struggled with drugs and alcohol while he taught us English, and was now drug and alcohol free and running the Discovery Center. So Peter introduced me to I'm okay, you're okay. It was simple, perhaps too simple, but if you feel okay about yourself, you are being self-compassionate. If you feel another person is okay, you are being compassionate. Self-loathing, then, equates to, I'm not okay, and so on. I learned that my desire to get high was really rooted in feeling that I'm not okay, and everyone else was okay. Peter asked, so why do you not feel okay, Larry? Start there. The truth was that I didn't feel worthy of my membership in any group. Like Groucho Marx said, I'd never want to be a member of a group that would have me as a member. But I needed to engage in the rituals of the group to feel worthy. I was bright enough to be with the brainiacs, but I didn't know it at the time. There was a group affectionately called the Greasers, but I didn't own a car or a motorcycle, and my curly hair would not work with that group anyway. So I chose the hippies, and well, getting high went with that. But the Discovery Center was full of hippies who didn't get high. That was new to me. These kids seemed cool and self-confident, and I couldn't understand why. I came to realize they thought of themselves as okay. What was equally hard to grasp is they seemed to think I was okay, too. How did that happen? Yet the more I listened and the more I hung out with these folks, the more I let go of the self-loathing I had been gripping so tightly. I was beginning to feel okay. Even the brainiacs and greasers seemed okay to me eventually. After all, they were just like me. We all wanted to run in one herd or another. There was the self and the herd that the self ran with. It was just a question of whether you sacrificed a part of yourself to join the herd. I wish I could give the gift of okay to someone. It's such an amazing gift. It's more complicated than that, of course. If there's one thing I learned, it's that this is not my gift to give. I work as a speech therapist with people who have lost language following a stroke. Some of these folks have amazing resilience and good support, but others no longer feel okay. Early in my career, I thought part of my job was to help restore their self-compassion, their okayness. Somehow, at the Discovery Center, we never got around to discussing how we get okay. One by one, most of us got there, what with the acceptance and support of those around us. The closest I can come to simulating that environment is the aphasia group that I run. These folks struggle to speak because they've had a stroke. Our agenda is minimal. If I tried to call it an encounter group, I'd probably decrease the membership by half. Similarly, I don't use terms like, I'm okay, you're okay. But truly, these are some of the most okay people I know. They became members of this herd while they were in the emergency room. By helping each other struggle with language, cheering each other on, and backing off where appropriate, I can see the growth in self-compassion there. They seem to get there at about the same time they express compassion for their fellow group members. Funny how that is. I can't take credit for their okayness. And like I say, it's not my gift to give. But it feels good to be in the room when it happens.
Thank you, Ross. As we heard the music from Ross, we also could hear music from some of the babies among us, announcing their okayness, reminding us of our okayness, our basic human okayness, and maybe we'll have continued reminders from that chorus. For this sermon in the series on compassion, I thought of a couple of subtitles, like Try a Little Tenderness, Starting with Yourself, or Try a Little Tenderness, or Else. The religious historian Karen Armstrong says no matter the religious tradition with which you identify, the practice of compassion is the essence of the spiritual life. The definition of compassion is an awareness of the experience of suffering in others or in ourselves. Compassion is the willingness to not ignore or turn away from the pain felt by others or by ourselves. Compassion includes the desire to act to reduce and alleviate suffering in others or in ourselves. In her book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, Armstrong names as her third step, compassion for yourself. It is foundational for how we treat others. Armstrong says, "The golden rule asks that we use our own feelings as a guide to our behavior with others. If we treat ourselves harshly, we are likely to treat other people this way too." Dr. Kristin Neff notes that our culture is big on promoting kindness to others, but we have a harder time treating ourselves tenderly when we suffer. Why is compassion to oneself under suspicion? Perhaps we mistake it for letting ourselves off the hook, ignoring morals and ethics and responsibilities. Neff says it is not a free pass at all. Taking responsibility for the needs of the world includes responsibility for ourselves and our self-care. It's good for us, like dental hygiene, exercise, nutrition, rest, and play, and community. Yet self-care seems to have a reputation as being self-indulgence. To be sure, there's money to be made in marketing self-indulgence under the name of self-care. Various cosmetics, clothing, automobiles, and food are sold as ways to pamper yourself. Marketing will tell us, you deserve a vacation, a luxury car, a fancy watch, a pint of ice cream. We may choose those things if we can, and we may enjoy them, but it's a stretch to say we deserve them. What we deserve is not based on our merits, money, virtues, or privileges. It comes from our basic humanity. Every human being deserves respect, compassion, dignity, and understanding. That seems a lot harder to come by than a pint of ice cream. Self-compassion is not self-indulgence. It's not even the same as self-esteem. Self-esteem means thinking well of yourself. Self-esteem comes from the value we give to our traits, like being attractive, smart, generous, athletic, hardworking, and so on. There's nothing wrong with praising our qualities and appreciating them, but Neff says that self-compassion is not based on self-evaluation. Self-compassion is the practice of unconditional friendship with your own feelings. Treating yourself with patience the way you would a friend. This is especially helpful when we are grieving a loss, Neff writes. Painful emotions can arise unexpectedly. Feelings can surprise and confuse us many months after a death or another major loss, even years after. Self-compassion means not rejecting your experience, but seeing it with tenderness. Yet our hurtful habits of self-criticism can be strong. Neff says, when we make a mistake or fail in some way, we may be more likely to beat ourselves up than to put a supportive arm around our own shoulder. And even when our problems come from forces beyond our control, such as an accident or a traumatic event, we often focus more on fixing the problem than calming and comforting ourselves. Neff is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Texas in Austin. She calls herself an evangelist for self-compassion. Yet unlike Karen Armstrong, she does not use religious history to make her point. she draws on empirical studies. With many articles to back her up and studies in different cultures and countries, Neff says that the practice of self-compassion is good for our sense of well-being. It can provide resilience against negative states of mind. It can reduce self-criticism, anxiety, depression, and harmful habits. It can make us feel better physically, too. So what is self-compassion? According to the Oxford Handbook of Compassion Science, self-compassion consists of three main elements: kindness, a sense of common humanity, and mindfulness. These components combine to create a self-compassionate frame of mind. Number one, kindness. What comes to mind? Not harshness, but gentleness. Not exasperation, but patience. An attitude of tender acceptance. Paying attention. Self-compassion is about giving yourself the gift of your own company. Neff puts it this way: treat yourself as you would treat a good friend. Number two, a sense of common humanity. When we feel pain about things we've done or those things we've left undone, when unhappy with our life situation, when grieving, when filled with stress or fear, it is easy to feel alone. We feel cut off and separate from other people, those who are presumably leading normal lives, happy lives, writes Neff. And she calls this falling into tunnel vision about our own lives. To get out of that tunnel, we need a reminder that imperfections and regrets affect the whole human family. We need a reminder that many people in the world experience loss, trauma, or pain from causes beyond our control. Self-compassion involves gaining the broader perspective, remembering our common humanity. The feeling that certain things shouldn't be happening can make us feel shame and isolation. Why am I the only one having such a bad experience? Why is my family singled out for this? Such questions are understandable. And this is why it can be so helpful to participate in groups of people dealing with similar struggles. Disease-related support groups, parenting or caregiver support meetings, grief groups, coming out groups, and addiction recovery programs. This means that reaching out to others has two benefits. We gain empathy for the struggles of other people, and we don't feel as isolated in our own experience. Truly, we can treat our neighbors and ourselves with respect and care. Number three, mindfulness. Paying attention to your experience can help you recognize that you are suffering. Neff says, many people don't acknowledge the extent of their own pain, especially when that pain stems from their own self-criticism. Likewise, when confronted with life challenges, people can get so absorbed by the process of trying to fix their problems that they don't pause to consider how much they're struggling in that moment. To notice that you are struggling is a kind thing to do for yourself, just as it would be with another person that you cared about. Mindfulness allows us to bear witness to our experience. Being aware of our feelings, we might meet unexpected challenges with reactions that are not so extreme. We can be less likely to berate ourselves or lash out at others if, instead of suppressing our unwanted feelings or numbing them, we look at them openly, kindly. Instead of rushing to fix things, we can bear witness to our feelings. Slow down the breathing pause, and merely notice, this is a moment of suffering. Out of care for our well-being, sometimes we choose to make a change in our lives. We may choose a new path of behavior. For example, recovery from addictions to smoking or drinking. In the long run, we may be happier and certainly healthier, but pain may be inevitable along the way. We can be honest and aware of the pain. To leave a house that we've lived in for many years, for decades, to leave and move to a new city or a smaller home or a facility with supportive staff. To do that may be a wise decision, but many people say this process is not an easy one. Transitions like leaving a job, ending a relationship, watching a child grow up and move away, all are normal human experiences and they can hurt. Self-compassion means noticing your experience with kindness, paying attention. This kind of attention is not the self-preoccupation that drives us away from the world. It is the self-awareness that allows us to engage with others and strive to be good for the world. There's very little space left in our hearts to care for others if we don't make enough space to care for ourselves in our hearts. But if we are grounded in friendship to our own experience, we can choose to respond to others also with respect and kindness, generosity and courage. Dr. Neff has posted a self-compassion survey on her website, a test. You answer a few questions, and right away it shows you how you measure on self-kindness, mindfulness, and seeing your pain as part of our shared humanity. I took her self-compassion test. My overall score was, well, barely above average. Actually, I thought it might be lower, but I was also relieved. I wouldn't want it to be too high and seem too satisfied. Neff asks this: how do you think things might change if you responded to yourself in the same way you typically respond to a close friend when that person is suffering? If you think human beings deserve dignity and respect, treat yourself that way. There are self-compassion workshops in our area and online. There are descriptions of self-compassion practices, like a meditation called affectionate breathing. If you are a person who doesn't like meditation or prayer, you could consider the alternative of writing down what you're feeling. That's another way of being mindful, is to write it down. If you can't sit still very long or feel that you're just too busy, consider taking a self-compassion break. It's not a scoop of ice cream or a shot of bourbon. As outlined by Kristen Neff, a self-compassion break is a brief, self-directed moment of recognition of what we're going through. I wish I had known about it a year ago. During my sabbatical from this congregation, I was finishing work on a dissertation for a Doctor of Ministry degree. The research and writing seemed unending. I was distracted and restless. Countless times I got up from the desk in my corner window to go into the kitchen and make tea or coffee. And then I'd get up to get a snack, and then get up to get more coffee. So many distractions. I felt miserable. Week after week, that unfinished, unformed book hung over my head. "Why did you wait so long?" I scolded myself. I felt like withdrawing from the school. However, by this time, it would have been more painful to explain why I gave up than to plow ahead. And what I didn't know then was this: rather than escaping to another coffee break or snack break or internet break, I could have taken a self-compassion break. It could have gone like this. I could have written in a journal or a letter to myself, or I could have sat quietly and said something along these lines. This is a moment of suffering. This is hard for me right now. But I'm not alone. Suffering is part of the human condition, especially for dissertation writers. Others have been here. May I be patient with myself. May I stay connected to my sources of encouragement. May I trust the process. That's what I could have done, a self-compassion break. Unfortunately, I was hard on myself. But Kristen Neff and Karen Armstrong have reminded me of this. The voice inside us that can criticize, minimize, belittle, and find fault is a voice that can be trained to be tender. With practice and support, we can learn to give ourselves a little more kind attention in our moments of distress or self-doubt. We can learn to sit with ourselves as we might sit with a good friend. Not blaming, not fixing, only bearing witness. Another way to learn self-compassion is to develop a sense of community. During my writing project, other people helped me more than I might have helped myself. Community. So the first source of help was this congregation. You sent me off with this message, get that thing done. Your wishes and prayers kept me going. And then my faculty advisor, Dr. Rondi Walker. As I finished a draft of a new chapter, I would email it to her and then get working on another one. And then she would email it back with her comments and recommendations. And then she would say, "You're going in the right direction. Keep writing." Finally, a few friends recalled their own writing projects. They could relate to the agony and confusion of being in the middle of the work. It is good to stay connected with others. Cultivating community is a form of self-care. Before closing, I would like to show you how a self-compassion break might work. So for a few minutes, I invite you to take a break as I offer you some words to think about in silence. If you don't wish to follow along, perhaps you can be a kind presence to the other people around you. Rest your eyes, whether open or closed. Notice your body resting where it is. And notice your breathing in and out. Now I'll ask you to think about a situation in your life that's not easy. It doesn't have to be a major event, but something that's a source of stress or sadness or pain. Something where you could use more kindness and ease. And as you bring this situation to mind, notice the feelings that come up. Now, offer yourself this insight. This is a moment of suffering. Or say to yourself, "Ow, this hurts. This is stressful for me." This is a moment of suffering. You are paying attention to the feeling. By saying this, you are being present for your experience. Now offer yourself this insight. Suffering is a part of life, everybody's life. We all struggle in our lives. We all have pain. I am not alone. Suffering is a part of life, all of our lives. By saying this, you affirm our common humanity and your place in the human family. Now consider how you would like to treat yourself and put a hand over your heart. Feel your warmth. Notice the gentle touch of your hand on your chest. Offer yourself a wish, perhaps one of the following. May I give myself the compassion that I need. May I learn to accept myself as I am. May I forgive myself. May I be strong. May I be patient. By saying things like this, you affirm your wish to be kind to yourself. And may your wish for kindness be like a seed that you're planting. And may it grow tenderly. And may it blossom in the days ahead. Okay. Thank you. You can open your eyes if they were closed. That's the outline for a self-compassion break. Thank you to those who participated, and thank you to those who supported the participants. I must confess that if I had set self-compassion as my New Year's resolution last week, I would have broken it by now, and probably beaten myself up for it. Perhaps in the interest of kindness, maybe setting one more task for ourselves, one more goal for self-improvement, is not the best approach. Perhaps instead of making a resolution, we can set an intention. Of course, we will not always make it. And this means we will not run out of opportunities to practice. Indeed, Karen Armstrong says, the work of becoming a compassionate human being is a lifelong project. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for others, compassion for the world is not achieved in an hour or a day. It is work that will last until our dying hour. Nearly every day we will fall short, but we can pick ourselves up and start over again. We can aim to treat ourselves as we would treat a good friend. We can practice. We can make the intention to be open to our feelings and experience, to remember our common humanity, and to act with tenderness toward ourselves as well as others. So may we aim to live for our own good, and for the good of our human family, of all beings, and of this world. Blessed be.